especially if you participated as an open socialist. At its base, the theory of the United Front and United Front Work stem from a need to work with other people who you don't completely agree with politically, but who you can agree with on a specific issue or demand. For example, many open socialists participate in anti-war coalitions and groups around the specific demand of ending the war. The international socialist organizations work with CAN, the Campus Anti-War Network, or with Palestinian rights organizations is a good example. We work as members within these groups or in coalition with activists from these organizations on the specific issue of ending the war or demanding Israel out of Palestine. And we do this because we believe that ending the war is going to benefit the working class and that we'll only end the war by participating in struggle against the war. Subsequently, the working class is only going to end the war if it goes out and struggles against the war. I don't think Obama's planning on just stopping war anytime soon. Not everyone we work with in these groups agrees with everything we have to say. For example, they may not agree with our position on a one-state solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict or the idea that the U.S. military is incapable of acting as a peacekeeping force and shouldn't be sent into countries in the name of humanitarian intervention. A lot of people in the anti-war movement still buy that the Afghanistan war is a good thing, and I would strongly disagree with that. And it's probably unlikely that those we're working with agree that we need to overthrow capitalism in order to end all wars. But we work with these people and organizations and the rank and file of these organizations, regardless of kind of where our political differences are. And it's going to take more than just us revolutionaries alone to end the war. And so that makes a lot of sense, right? Like, we go into other organizations, we work on a specific issue, and we want to see an end to the war or any other issues. So if that makes a lot of sense to everybody, then I guess I'm done, because I've explained the entire theory of the United Front, and you all have a perfect understanding of it now, right? It's too early for everybody to get jokes? Okay, now. So, if only it were that easy. In essence, the United Front theory makes sense for a lot of activists, but if we take a look at history, we can unfortunately find all too many examples that point to the fact that while revolutionaries, and I'm going to separate revolutionaries from activists here, may have had a superficial understanding of the United Front, or at least understood its relevance and usefulness, they didn't actually fully understand the tactic and made either tragic mistakes of abstaining from United Front work at crucial historical moments or participating in kind of bastardized versions of the United Front. So if we're going to successfully engage in United Front activity, which I consider necessary given the current historical situation, it's important to have a sound understanding of the theory. Now, I've just used the term theory and tactic interchangeably when describing the United Front. I'm going to continue to do that for the rest of this talk. The theory, first written down, drawn out, and elucidated by Trotsky in 1922, but developed in practice prior to that time, is both a theory and a tactic, and it's important to keep this in mind. I'll get into this a bit later in the talk, but as a tactic, as with any tactic, whether sometimes United Front action is the best way forward, and sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it's the tactic we choose, and sometimes it's not. Determining whether or not it's a correct tactic at any given time is kind of a larger issue and one that has to be based on a materialist understanding of the situation at hand. And just kind of keep that in mind as I go through a couple historical examples later on. So as I stated earlier, the need to participate in a united front stems from the necessity of allying with other people who we don't necessarily agree with on everything politically in order to win concrete demands. And when I'm referring to people, generally what I mean is members of the working class. The struggles that we as socialists would be engaged in are those struggles that benefit the working class and generally those that subsequently are detrimental to the bourgeoisie, the ruling class. It's unlikely then that we'd be allying with the bourgeoisie in struggle unless we've made a pretty serious error politically. We should be allying in struggle with those who are oppressed, and in a very broad brushstroke, this is the working class as oppressed by the ruling class. So backing up a step, the United Front, as I said, stems from the need to work with other people who we don't necessarily agree with completely to win concrete demands. And there's a couple of really crucial points in that statement. First, the need to work with other people who we don't entirely agree with politically. What presupposes United Front work is, one, the fact that we still live under capitalism and aren't close to a revolution yet, and two, that the working class has mixed and uneven consciousness. So imagine if we didn't have to work with people who didn't agree with revolutionary socialist politics in order to end the war. That would mean that a massive number of people had, in fact, reached revolutionary conclusions because we'd be working with people who agree with us. And at that point, we'd probably be well beyond calling just for an end of the war, but we'd also be calling for a socialist revolution. You know, the reality of the time we live in is that not every worker, and by no means the majority of the working class, has reached the level of consciousness where they see the need to overthrow capitalism. The conclusion that many have come to, on the other hand, is that the war is neither in their interest nor in the interest of the majority of Iraqis or Afghanis, or they've quite simply come to consider the war wrong for some reason, be it morally, because it sucks tax money away from things that would actually benefit the majority of people, and so on and so forth. But in some sense, workers who are against the war have reached a higher stage of political consciousness than those who aren't against the war. So in order to fight with any possibility of winning for an end to the war, we need to ally ourselves with those workers who also want to end the war. To refuse to work with them would mean isolating ourselves from those who have a more advanced political consciousness but who haven't yet reached revolutionary conclusions. And for a revolutionary to isolate themselves from this layer of workers would mean not only cutting ourselves off from even the potential of ending the war or winning any other reform, but it would also mean cutting ourselves off from those people who are a step forward in consciousness, those who we want to talk to, debate with, and bring closer to revolutionary conclusions. So I'm going to go back to the statement about the United Front that I made earlier. The second part of the statement about United Front work is also important, working with others to win concrete demands. Engaging in a United Front is about engaging in struggle to defend rights that are being chipped away or to demand rights that have been lost. I've used the example of the war a lot here, but any issue could really be used, you know, whether it's demanding single-payer health care, the right to collective bargaining, the rights for gays and lesbians to marry, so on and so forth. Without a concrete demand, United Front work would be meaningless because there wouldn't be a specific issue to ally with reformist coalitions on, and there would be nothing to organize with their rank and file around. So struggle for a specific reform, then, is central. But United Front work is not solely about actually winning the fight for reforms. And please don't take that statement to mean that I don't want to see struggles for reforms end in success. I absolutely do. But the process of struggle is just as important to the tactic as the outcome of that struggle. As an independent organization, even though, you know, the ISO is small, we could proclaim that we stand in support of a particular reform and could, if we chose to, struggle towards it on our own. You know, whether or not we'd actually win a struggle that we're fighting on our own, I'm not quite so sure about that one. The tactic of the United Front is about engaging in the struggle for these reforms with the working class, because it's through this struggle and through the arguments and debates that will come up during this struggle that we have the opportunity to engage with radicalizing workers and draw them farther left. Some will have come into contact with socialist ideas or the ideas of socialism in the past, but even though they think socialism, you know, may be a good thing, they still have hope in reforming the system in the good intentions of their trade union leaders, the liberal anti-war leaders, or, you know, crazy as it may seem at this point, even just the liberal rhetoric of Obama. You know, he says we're going to give you some things, and they're kind of like, okay, maybe at some point you're going to give us these things. And while for us it may be clear that the things we need, whether it be an end to the war, single-payer health care, gay marriage, will not simply be handed down by this liberal leadership, I think a lot of folks in this room and at this conference realize that we need to go out and actually demand those things and fight for them if we want to see them happen. For a lot of people out there, they do believe that, you know, these things may just be handed down. They believe in kind of the rhetoric that comes out of this of the liberal leadership. And the clearest indicator that liberal leaders aren't on their side may actually be the betrayal they feel when they're led astray by those that promised health care, higher wages, workers' rights, and then, you know, they either, or those liberal leaders either reneged on those promises or turned around and damped down struggle. And we see Obama, the Obama administration, not just Obama himself, doing that right now. While many people who voted for Obama still think he's a good president, they're very quickly losing faith that he'll follow through on any of the promises made during his election campaign. And a lot of people who are losing faith are wondering, okay, so, you know, voting for him wasn't enough. What do we do? How do we actually win the changes we need? There are a lot of other people that are simply kind of in a holding pattern, still believing the rhetoric that they just have to keep waiting for changes. You know, now just isn't the time. We've seen for many years that the message of, you know, hold on, just wait, we'll give it to you eventually, is put forward by liberals liberals and reformist leadership beyond just Obama. A lot of, whether it's healthcare organizations, you know, trade union organizations, where the leadership is saying, you know, just wait, you know, don't get too radical, you'll get it eventually. That's a message that comes out of a lot of leadership. And so the leadership of reformist organizations then may be inclined to hold people back. And the question kind of arises in United Front work, are we approaching the leaders of organizations? And I just want to make this point about leadership real quickly. So, you know, are we knowledgeably acting in coalition with reformist leadership bodies? Because the question of the United Front work is not just about, you know, struggling with tons of people. It's also a question of, okay, we're approaching an organization here. Are we working with their leadership? And the answer, as I see it, and as I believe Trotsky and other revolutionaries have seen it, is yes. In order to move the struggles of today forward and to be engaged and involved in struggle with the working class, it's going to be necessary that we engage with other groups. Now, the focus of this work should always be on the working class. Is the work that we're engaged in benefiting the working class? You know, are we engaging in struggle with workers and not solely with their leadership? You know, if the answer to either of these questions is no, then the current struggle we're engaged in needs to be reevaluated. But to think that we could engage in United Front struggle United Front work without approaching the leadership of other organizations would be a little bit foolish. Regardless of whether or not we're engaged in United Front struggle, we should be appealing to workers to join or to work with a revolutionary organization. To make an appeal to other organizations for United Front action assumes that we'll be appealing to the leadership of those organizations. If we were appealing only to the rank and file, we'd be doing no more than what we should be doing every day. There may be some reformist leaders who are appealing to us, or maybe there may be some reformist leaders who we're appealing to who are closer to us politically than others, you know, some who are less liberal or reformist in nature. But generally, we'll have to figure out how to interact and relate to liberal leadership in order to fight and hopefully win necessary battles. And in the process, you know, involve ourselves in struggle with the rank and file of those organizations that we're working with. So if that was a little bit muddled, I apologize, but I do think it's important to put out there that, you know, there's kind of rank and file of organizations that we want to be working with, and we should be appealing to people every day, appealing to workers to fight against or to fight for a certain reform. But if we're actually approaching an organization or a larger group, you know, to ally with in coalition on a particular reform, we're going to have to appeal to the leadership of that organization in order to make that alliance. So by engaging in struggle with workers attempting to win reforms, we're gonna we'll be able to outline and explain why it is that liberal leadership can only go so far, and why a break with that leadership may be necessary to push the struggle forward, and why ultimately a revolution is necessary so that we don't constantly have to fight for reforms, but actually live in a rational society that benefits the vast majority of people. Additionally, and I'll be a little bit shameless about this one, you know, revolutionaries are, you know, leftist, I'm just going to say revolutionaries, we're usually pretty good activists. Why? The experience of fighting many battles, a historical knowledge of strategy and tactics, knowledge of the struggles that have occurred in the past, in combination with a political analysis of the situation, that's usually pretty smack dab on the money. We have a lot to offer other activists, be they anti-war activists or trade unionists, and the knowledge, guidance, and leadership that we can provide in struggle proves to workers our leadership abilities. You know, a crucial step towards winning workers to the project of building a revolutionary party, or of backing and supporting the project that we're engaged in. So to quote Trotsky, "It is precisely in the course of struggle that broad masses must learn from experience that we fight better than the others, that we see more clearly than the others, that we are more audacious and resolute. In this way, we shall bring closer the hour of the United Revolutionary Front under the undisputed communist leadership." So I've spoken a fair amount here about what socialists can bring to and get out of United Front work. We have a lot to offer the organizations that we're out working with, just with our experience in struggle. But in order to do these things, to argue against liberal reformist politics, to argue with people that Obama's not just going to hand things down, and to argue instead for socialist politics, to argue eventually for socialism instead of capitalism, it's necessary to be involved in United Front work as open socialists. This may seem straightforward, but it isn't always easy. So coming out as a socialist can lead to red-baiting, internal squabbling, campaigns against you, or even simply a reluctance on the part of non-socialists to believe anything you have to say. And this is also coming from somebody who was involved in a lot of kind of United Front work in organizations in like the Bush years, when things were really bad sometimes for leftists, where it was kind of a different period. People were like, ooh, socialists, like, I don't really want to work with you because you guys are a little bit crazy. Now I think it's a very different time where it's a lot easier and people are very kind of open to our ideas. But, you know, it still can sometimes be a little bit of a struggle to be like an out, open, engaged socialist in whatever coalition you're working with. But, you know, you can move past that. It's pretty easy to move beyond that. You know, as we work with people, it can become, or people will see in the process of struggle that, you know, we know what we're doing. And it's less likely that red baiting or reluctance to listen to what we have to say, it's less likely that's going to happen as people see what it is that we're doing on a daily basis, that we actually do know what we're doing and that we have a lot to offer to the struggles that are at hand. So all the examples I've used so far to help explain United Front work, mainly anti-war work, are rooted in the situations we find ourselves in today. And this is quite a different time than the late teens and early 20s of the 19th century, when Trotsky first wrote a pamphlet on the United Front. You know, that was a time of revolutionary upheavals in Europe. And I, you know, while there's some upheavals going on around the world, you know, and maybe some people may consider them revolutionary, I think we're in a little bit different of a situation than when these ideas were first laid out. But even in that period, when a much larger portion of the working class had been won to leftist political ideas, the question of engaging in United Front work with the working class for a common cause was crucial. One of the earliest and best examples of a United Front in practice occurred in Russia in July 1917, just a few months after the February Revolution and prior to the decisive revolutionary upheavals in October. Russia was not yet governed by the workers, but instead by a coalition government consisting of both bourgeois and proletariat. At the head of this government was Kerensky, who was a liberal social democrat with no intention of actually handing power to the working class. And I think there were a number of talks on Russia this weekend, but I'm going to just kind of blow through a whole bunch of history here and not explain it a lot. So I encourage folks to go out and read about this period of time. It's really amazing. So the Bolsheviks and workers of Petrograd, as well as Kerensky and his government, were threatened by the far-right counter-revolutionary forces of General Kornilov, who was attempting a coup. So we saw the start of the Russian Revolution in February 1917 and kind of the culmination of it in October. And there was a lot of stuff that happened in between, including, you know, folks coming in and trying to decisively smash it and say, you know, no, workers can't actually have power. The Bolsheviks, you know, realized the gravity of the situation, that General Kornilov was coming in and attempting to, you know, completely overturn the gains that had been made. And so they mobilized their forces against Kornilov in coalition with those in Petrograd who wanted to uphold the gains of the revolution. And now this was a united front because the Bolsheviks were not politically on the same page as everyone they were allied with in the struggle against Kornilov. They were actually working with and fighting, you know, with Kerensky and kind of the liberal government. But the Bolsheviks made very clear in their propaganda and rhetoric their political stance against Kornilov and the counter-revolutionary forces, but also against Kerensky and the bourgeois government. The Bolsheviks and the workers eventually won the day, sending Kornilov packing before he had even reached Petrograd. And, you know, in the process of staunchly upholding the revolution, the Bolsheviks were able to win a larger section of the working class to their political program, which was a program of actual workers' revolution, in part because they were able to point to the fact that, you know, as was kind of shown in practice, the liberals at the time weren't actually for workers' control and were barely provoked enough to defend their government against Kornilov. And the defense of the Kerensky government, for that matter, or the defense by Kerensky and his forces was lackluster enough that it wouldn't have really had any effect and would have easily been toppled by Kornilov had the working class of Petrograd not risen in its defense. So the Russian Revolution was eventually successful with the political leadership and guidance of the Bolshevik Party, but Russia couldn't stand in isolation. And the revolutionary left throughout the remainder of Europe was left to grapple with the question of how to definitively win the majority of the working class to their revolutionary program in order to successfully carry out a revolution and help support the Russian workers' government. And this, you know, the question of how to win the majority of the working class was a really key question at the time. And subsequently, the question of the United Front became really important. Trotsky recognized the importance of the tactic for revolutionaries of the time, as written, you know, 5 years after the Kornilov coup in the pamphlet on the United Front. This was written in March of 1922. Number one of the general consideration of the United Front is as follows. The task of the Communist Party is to lead the proletarian revolution. In order to summon the proletariat for the direct conquest of power and to achieve it, the Communist Party must base itself on the overwhelming majority of the working class. So long as it does not hold this majority, the party must fight to win it. The party can achieve this only by remaining an absolutely independent organization with a clear program and strict internal discipline. So, you know, parties around Europe were trying to figure out, okay, how do we actually get to the point where we have a majority of the working class on our side in order to definitively smash capitalism and have a workers' government instead? And the Bolsheviks, you know, as we saw, fought with the liberals against Kornilov while maintaining the independence that, that Trotsky spoke of in that passage. And that's what allowed them to put forward revolutionary slogans and win sections of the workers by pointing out the limitations of the Kerensky government. As Lenin put it during the Kornilov fight, we shall fight, we are fighting against Kornilov just as Kerensky's troops do, but we do not support Kerensky. On the contrary, we expose his weakness. At the moment, we must campaign not so much directly against Kerensky as indirectly against him, namely by demanding a more and more active, truly revolutionary war against Kornilov. The development of this war alone can lead us, the Bolsheviks, to power. So it was made very clear that, yes, we are fighting for something in this particular case against Kornilov and against the counter-revolutionary forces, and we're fighting in coalition with people, but we're also calling out those folks that we're fighting in coalition with because we don't necessarily agree with where they are politically. We don't think that the Kerensky government is actually a revolutionary government. And this is exactly the tack we must take in our United Front work today. You know, political independence is crucial for the United Front to be an effective revolutionary tactic, and the United Front is necessary for winning the majority of the working class to our side. So now that I've gotten through this early example of United Front work, I'm going to jump forward in time a bit to the period when the United Front tactic was outlined on paper, at least for specific political reasons. By the end of 1921, the Russian Revolution had entered a clear new stage, and that was one of decline. In this period, the Third International, often coined the Comintern, was grappling with the question of which way forward for international revolution. As the members of the Comintern, a grouping of international revolutionaries, saw it, revolution was required in a country other than Russia in order for Russia to remain a true worker state. The revolution needed to spread. Russia couldn't survive in isolation. It needed another country, hopefully one with a more advanced industrial capacity than what Russia had. Unfortunately, no other party in the world had the backing of the majority of their country's working class, and many organizations were misjudging the situation on the ground, generally tending towards an ultra-left stand, refusing to ally with non-revolutionary workers or parties on the questions of the day. And so the question of the United Front became really crucial as countries like Italy, Germany, Bulgaria, and France saw revolutionary moments come and go. And it was crucial both for those countries and the prospect of revolution in those countries, but also for Russia and the upholding of the Russian Revolution. So I've really only got time to focus on one example, and unfortunately it's an example that has an entire meeting devoted to the topic going on at this very moment. If the meeting on how the German Revolution was lost and led to the rise of Hitler is available on audio after the conference, and you want a deeper understanding of the United Front as well as a better understanding of, well, what happened in Russia, of the rise of fascism, the Comintern strategy and tactics, I'd really suggest you pick that up as an MP3. A talk on the United Front and a talk on the failure of the German Revolution could kind of go together and be the same talk to some extent. So this particular example is often the one considered most crucial to the Russian situation, the failure of the Russian Revolution and the decline of socialist revolution in Europe, and that would be the German Revolution from 1918 to 1923. The revolutionary, or so-called revolutionary, depending on which party you're referring to, left in Germany was the largest and most organized, aside from Russia, in Europe, and had the most potential to carry out a revolution. And while there were many political errors that led to the failure of the German Revolution, each of which is related to strategy, tactics, party building, and each of which could be a talk in and of itself, one of the crucial moments is intimately tied to the question of the United Front. So in March 1919, the Kapp Putsch, an attempt at a rightist coup, which was very similar politically to what had occurred in Russia with General Kornilov, happened. And the German Social Democratic Party, the KPD, was faced with the decision of whether or not to ally with the workers and the bourgeois non-revolutionary government controlled by the SPD in taking a stand against the politician Wolfgang Kapp and his band of right-wing army officers who was attempting to take power. In Berlin, the initial response of the KPD leadership was actually to abstain from struggle and to urge workers to abstain from the struggle between the SPD and the right-wingers. So, you know, instead of the situation in Russia where you have a right-wing kind of attack on revolution and you have the Bolsheviks allying with more liberal forces in order to prevent that attack, in Germany you have the situation of the KPD, the German Social Democratic Party, saying, no, we actually shouldn't really, we don't want to be working with the liberals to fight against this rightist coup, which seems a little bit crazy. You know, the ultra, it was an ultra-left position, and the KPD party, or the KPD center, considered both the Putschists, I can never pronounce that word, Putschists, and the SPD to be counter-revolutionary elements. They didn't really make a differentiation between the extreme right and the not revolutionary but at least liberal SPD. The working class, on the other hand, did recognize the difference between the two, and they saw the danger that the Putschists posed. The German Trade Union Federation called a general strike, engaging more than 12 million workers. Armed resistance to the push was led by both individuals and groups of members of the USPD and of both communist parties. There were a lot of communist parties in Germany at the time, so go and read. There were a lot of communist parties at the time. I should have made a hand up. So the KPD eventually realized the error of its analysis and saw that the call to abstain from struggle was alienating them from the working class. They reversed course and officially joined in the struggle against CAP, who was defeated. But the putsch was eye-opening to the working class and the Communist Party in Germany, and both the USPD and KPD gained votes and influence out of it. But the initial abstention from struggle against the putschists remained a huge error on the KPD's part. Had the KPD chosen to engage in united front action with the liberal bourgeois against the, or you know, even with just kind of the reformists against the putschists, they would have gained more political relevance in the eyes of the German working class and had the opportunity to prove their leadership abilities to the German workers. So, you know, you kind of saw a rise of the left. You know, people in Germany realized the dangers that right forces posed, and they actually wanted to see, you know, a stronger left, more, you know, working class, radical government. But you had the situation where the KPD, like the official left organ in Germany, was saying, you know, no, we're going to abstain from struggle. We don't want to ally with bourgeois forces. And the working class was like, what? I think that's kind of crazy. You know, had the KPD put out a specific line, as the Bolsheviks put out against Kornilov and against Kerensky during the Kornilov coup, the KPD may have been able to help shape the developments after the coup, you know, encouraging revolutionary organization and activity. Instead, the working class defeated CAP. The SPD government was exposed as liberals who were unable or unwilling to fight the right, and consciousness generally shifted leftward, but the revolutionary working class movement wasn't necessarily strengthened. The KPD wasn't able to really win a lot of workers to its side because it had made this initial call saying, you know, don't go out and fight. We don't want to be fighting with the liberals. Also, you know, on the flip side, had the KPD made a call similar to what the Bolsheviks had made in Russia against Kornilov, they probably would have been able to draw a much larger section of workers to their revolutionary organization, you know, to the organization that was actually attempting to carry out an actual workers' revolution. So by 1923, the German Revolution had gone down in defeat. And one of the reasons why I use Germany as an example is because the example kind of continues in Germany with a lack of clarity on United Front work or kind of skewing when and how the tactic is used. So the German revolutionaries, even by 1923 and post-1923, the leaders of the KPD and later leaders of the VKPD still hadn't learned their lesson regarding engaging in a United Front. Even if they claimed an understanding of the United Front tactic, their actual understanding of it was skewed. As the German Revolution declined and the fascist right gained power in the years 1923 and 1932, the German communists continued to take an ultra-left stance on the question of the United Front. Their line about social democratic parties was something they termed social fascism. And this was also coming out of kind of the Stalin-controlled Comintern at the time. In other words, while the social democrats weren't fascists, they were social fascists, and just as detrimental to the working class as the fascists themselves. And I'll read a quick quote from Stalin on kind of this skewed idea. In this situation of growing imperialist contradiction and sharpening of the class struggle, fascism becomes more and more the dominant method of bourgeois rule. In countries where there are strong social democratic parties, Fascism assumes the particular form of social fascism, which to an ever-increasing extent serves the bourgeoisie as an instrument for paralyzing the masses in struggle against the regime of fascist dictatorship. So skewing, actual fascists and relating social democrats who, yeah, they weren't revolutionary, but they weren't fascists. Actual fascists was a line, put out by Stalin and taken up by German communists at the time. And this led to the really bizarre situation of communists and Nazis out on the street together in support of a strike and picket in 1932, with both groups trying to win the support of the working class and both hostile to social democrats, which is most certainly, in my opinion, one of the most bizarre perversions of the United Front, a united front with the Nazis in favor of a strike against the bourgeois social democrats. So when speaking about perversions of the United Front, it's also important to bring up the theory of the popular front, which is something people may have heard about or be familiar with, a tactic put forward by the Comintern, and by this point the Comintern really meant Stalin, in the 1930s. The idea of the Popular Front was to unite with political groups or parties, but in contradiction to the United Front, the Union was not necessarily in the name of a particular demand or action. While the United Front is a tactic for unity in action, the Popular Front often meant unity for unity's sake, be it in Parliament, in the formation of a political party, in an election bloc, and so on and so forth. In addition, unity in a popular front didn't require maintaining political independence from those you were allied with. So here's Trotsky on the United Front. We participate in a united front, but do not for a single moment become dissolved in it. We function in the United Front as an independent detachment. And we do this for the reasons I've previously outlined. The underlying point, on the other hand, of the popular front is exactly the opposite. That is to say that to engage in a popular front, generally with bourgeois forces and often for bourgeois demands, one is forced to become dissolved politically in that work. So here we have kind of the two distinct differences between a united front and a popular front. The first, as opposed to engaging in struggle with the working class, popular frontism doesn't necessarily distinguish on a class basis who you're uniting with. And two, engaging in united front work means standing firm on your political ideals. If you disagree with a tactic or political slogan, you lay out why and attempt to win the majority of those involved to a better and hopefully a socialist line. And popular fronts involve compromising political beliefs, not arguing them out, not trying to turn the tide of opinion in order to maintain what you would consider some type of political support, even if that support is, you know, coming from working class liberals or ruling class bourgeoisie. It didn't really seem to matter to folks in the 30s. And the practical outcome of a popular front tactic was that revolutionaries united with social democratic parties in election blocs or political parties, generally in the name of fighting fascism. But in doing so, the interests of the working class in the program of building a revolutionary party was lost. When revolutionary situations did arise in France and Spain in 1936, the parties that should and could have been providing revolutionary guidance and leading a revolution had effectively dissolved. Their politics had become declarified because they had gone into coalition with these organizations, not actually argued out socialist politics, and thus kind of dampened down their own politics. They weren't actually really revolutionary parties anymore. They were politically incapable of leading a revolution, much less of participating in a democratically controlled worker state after a revolution. So the examples I went through of successful United Front work in the case of the Bolsheviks and the Kornilov coup, of unsuccessful organizing attempts when United Front work was shunned in the case of Germany, of bastardized United Front work with fascists, of political impotence created by the Popular Front work, it makes it kind of clear why the theory of the United Front is important. United Front work in and of itself may seem like an obvious tactic to us today. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if the majority of folks in this room have been saying to yourself, of course we need to work with those who are not quite with us in the revolutionary struggle. You know, work with them to win reforms and also to break them from the liberals and win them to socialist ideas. You know, what would I be doing with my time if I weren't doing just that? And I think the theory seems obvious and makes sense for a number of reasons. I'm going to kind of go through maybe two of them. So first, the majority of the serious leftists remaining in the U.S. today, and really there aren't very many of us, we come out of a Trotskyist tradition, so we literally kind of grew up politically with United Front work as a necessary component of our task of rebuilding a socialist left and building towards a revolutionary party. And second, we have all these historical examples that I've been through and countless others to look at and see the successes when United Front action has been taken and the failures when it hasn't. And because we're serious socialists, we have a tendency to engage in struggle. Without engaging in struggle, we'd be isolated and alienated from the working class, and our function would be a self-serving one of propagandism, armchair activism, you know, revolutionary rhetoric with no actual revolutionary activity. We're not the type of folks, I think, that want to go and just sit in a room and have endless debates for years on end. We actually want to go out and engage with people. But historical examples and a general understanding of the theory isn't necessarily enough. And this is kind of what I was alluding to back at the very beginning of the talk. The KPD leaders in Germany, you know, Zinoviev and other central committee leaders of the Comintern in Russia, party leaders in Italy, France, and Spain, you know, those who misjudged the need for United Front work or who followed Stalin's popular front line later, you know, they had examples of successful United Front work that they could look to. You know, the first example that I went through, the fight against Kornilov in Russia, occurred in 1917, well before any of the examples that followed. And successful trade union organizing work, you know, which is kind of considered a prime example of the United Front, have been occurring and have been fostered by leftists for many years. So we have these examples, and other revolutionaries have had these examples, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the correct tactic is always chosen at the correct time. I think an in-depth understanding of the theory, which I've really only just started to cover, and hopefully we can flesh out a little bit more in discussion, in combination with a materialist understanding of the situation on the ground in which you're attempting to apply that theory, is really crucial. The United Front is merely a tactic, which may or may not be the correct one to choose at any given time. The decision of whether or not to implement the tactic must be based on an analysis of the current situation, and, you know, hopefully an analysis by those enough closer to the struggle to fully understand it. The United Front tactic may not always be the most appropriate one. It's a tactic of the defensive, you know, one we use to defend the few rights we as workers have or to gain a few more. It's a tactic of the defensive because we're using it in our struggle against capitalism. When revolutionaries are faced with the opportunity to go on the offensive, when we have the vast majority of the working class with us, which we're nowhere near yet, but, you know, I'm putting this out there because I think it's an important part of United Front and also of a question of strategy and tactics, you know, when we have the opportunity to actually go on the offensive, when toppling the state in coalition with masses of workers who believe that toppling the state and creating a dictatorship of the proletariat is in their best interest, when we're faced with that situation, United Front action would no longer be applicable. There would be no reason to ally with those to the right of us because we'd have the majority of the working class that would rally behind us, and that's eventually what we're fighting towards. So in our work today, the United Front is generally the correct tactic. We're not really anywhere close to having a majority of the working class with revolutionary consciousness, and I can't really foresee choosing not to unite and fight for reform because the alternative would be standing aside from the call for reform and isolating ourselves from the working class. So after this, you know, really fun and possibly exhausting week into socialism, I have no doubt that most of you are going to go back to your everyday work, you know, back to the miscellaneous coalitions, groups, trade unions that you're involved in with. Like I said, everybody raised their hand at the beginning when I asked the question of how many people have been involved in activist work. I hope that we're going to continue to be involved in that activist work. And if you haven't seen this work as United Front work in the past, I encourage folks to take a minute to think about whether or not the tactics of the United Front apply in that work. You know, are you allying with people who you don't completely agree with politically? Are you fighting for a reform? Are you engaging in or leading struggle and arguing a political line that comes from a socialist perspective? Are you an open member of the International Socialist Organization? Are you a member of the International Socialist Organization? Have you attempted or are you attempting to explain to people why it is that Obama isn't following through on the promises he made during the election cycle? Because, you know, now, if any time, is a great time to be pointing out the inadequacies of liberal leadership. You know, the inadequacies are blatantly clear for all to view. And I think, you know, taking that step back to take a look at what you're engaged in and whether or not the United Front theory applies or the tactic applies is kind of important because sometimes we get so involved and engaged in the struggle that we don't really think about, you know, how it is that we're engaging. So I would encourage folks, you know, to just step back and take a minute, you know, are you applying the tactics of the United Front or not? You know, the working class, a lot of people are out there radicalizing right now because of the economic situation and because of a whole host of other issues. And the left is growing, revolutionary groups are growing. By engaging in United Front work, being clear about our politics, you know, we can win people to a revolutionary tradition or to supporting kind of the revolutionary tradition that we are upholding and building a stronger revolutionary organization in the short term as we win more and more people to a revolutionary organization. And as we're doing that, laying the groundwork for a revolutionary party that will eventually have the backing and support of the masses and be able to definitively carry out a revolution, which would hopefully make United Front work no longer necessary. So, thanks.
right. So we have a lot of time for discussion. Hopefully people have been to some other workshops and know how this goes, but just raise your hand. I'll call on you, probably describe you by your clothes since I don't know most people. And, you know, if I ask you to wrap up, it's only because I want to allow everyone in the room to be able to speak. And you can respond to anything that Andrea said that you disagree with, any questions that you have, and we'll see. Maybe she'll come back, or maybe other people can try to take up and answer those questions. All right, we'll go ahead and start with you.
Yeah, I had a question about the NPA, and which is like the French New Capitalist, New Anti-Capitalist Party. The LCR, which is, you know, like the Ligue Revolutionnaire Communist Party in France. They dissolved themselves into the New Anti-Capitalist Party, and it seems like that action is more what I understand of a popular front tactic, because, you know, there is no clear program, only in the sense that, like, you know, they said that, you know, we're, being a Marxist is not, you know, is not a requirement of being involved. We're not going to really raise the banner of Trotskyism, like, sort of doctrinaire debates no longer seem to matter, and it seems almost as if, like, for example, if the ISO were to dissolve itself into the global justice movement and to sort of unite with any sort of vague anti-capitalism, anti-corporatist coalition, and not actually keep its independence, keep its own organization, and that, and so I had a question about that, and also the, like, because it's easy to see opportunism in retrospect, so you see the consequences and you see sort of things, but it's really hard to see it in the present, in a certain sense. So.
Mm-hmm. I agree, Francois. I have you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry, and you can be next.
What's the concern about losing membership in United Front, whether the other side has a very charismatic person or through outright bribery?
Mm-hmm. All right. Francois?
So the basic distinction maybe between like a popular and a United Front would be one is about, it seems like the United Front is about like a specific issue, whereas the popular front is more joining as one political party. I mean, would that be like a fair distinction?
All right, so we have a few good questions out there. Again, people feel free to try to answer them if you want.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I reckon you've got to be careful about using these terms in relation to today, because a lot of how Trotsky outlined their tactics was based on the existence of sizable revolutionary organisations that had a following amongst the working class, and that they could actually show in practice to the workers that looked to the reformist leaders that they could deliver things. Like, it took the Bolsheviks to defend the provisional government in Russia, and that they could actually deliver on that. It wasn't just a matter of argument or ideas. And there's nowhere in the world today where there's a revolutionary organisation that, through having some alliance with reformist forces, is able to demonstrate in practice that revolutionary politics is what's needed to defend the working class against an attack from the right. And in the process of doing that, win masses of workers away from reformist leaders. There's, you know, that's not the reality anywhere in the world today, which isn't to say that aspects of what Trotsky argued can't be useful in, and something of a guide to action of how revolutionaries should function today, but it's not, you can't just sort of transpose it. And so I think in no way does it sort of apply to the anti-capitalist party in France, partly as well, because the LCR is not a traditional revolutionary organisation, but kind of an alliance of different groups with quite different politics and that sort of thing. And I think as well the thing about the Popular Front is that it's an alliance with non-working class forces, and it's like it's got to be seen as pure pro-capitalist ideology, that it was a way for Stalin to try and get more allies and more client states around the world through just, you know, the so-called revolutionaries trying to form alliances and take control of national governments, capitalist governments, that could be client states for Russia, and with, you know, that they needed as a new capitalist ruling class, they needed client states to compete with their imperialist rivals. So it's got nothing to do with, you know, bringing about overthrowing capitalism. But so in that sense, like today, a lot of the alliances revolutionaries have are with non-working class forces, like in the anti-war movement, work with like people from churches and all this, which are not in no way have a following amongst the working class, and through an alliance with them we can win workers away. So that's not to say the anti-war movement's a popular front and therefore it's unprincipled. But today, given the fact that left-wing ideas are quite marginal, that you have to obviously work with a whole range of different forces, and these Trotsky series don't actually immediately kind of apply. And if they did, I think, if we thought they did, that would be quite disorienting.
Louise basically just said a lot of things that I was going to say. But I guess we just, I mean, I had probably a couple of things. One on the thing of the LCR, I know there's a lot of curiosity about what's going on with the NPA and stuff, but I think it's also a little bit presumptuous of us to basically, from what I heard you saying, Alex, it's a little presumptuous of us to say you're trying to pull a popular front type move or it's being opportunist. I don't know facts on the ground. I think we actually have to kind of let that thing develop. The fact that there's been a new anti-capitalist party of 10,000 members formed in France, to me, is an important development. We have to see what that goes and what the prospects are for building a Leninist organization, you know, with that or have you, but I don't want to pull a snap judgment on that one. And I think, you know, what Louise is saying is, like, about the Popular Front and as a Stalinist tactic and stuff, we have to understand, like, Popular Front is not a type of United Front. It's a different thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, because it went from the Popular Front to the Democratic Front. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of, like, I mean, as Louise was getting at, this served the ends of the Stalinist regime at a given time. It was not ever meant as a step towards revolution. United Front is and I think, again, going to what Louise says, the importance of understanding United Front both as a theory and a practice, a theory which was developed through practice, right, during a particular period of struggle in international working class struggle, in the great examples that Andrea gave, but also that while it does serve as the model that we use now, and also the application is not the same, I think, for the reasons that Louise laid out. There are no mass working class parties at the moment. Certainly not in the U.S., and the Labor Party is in a completely different situation. But I think understanding the United Front as a tactic really means, like, you know, from the defense of conserving working class forces, but, you know, in other situations, like, you know, developing working class forces in the sense of politics, consciousness, organization, and you know, for actual struggle, you know what I mean? And that is certainly not, Popular Front actually has historically served the purpose of just, if not dissolving that, of driving it into the dirt, because it was not ever aimed at, you know, a revolution, so.
All right, and before I call on Steve, I just want to remind us, still a question out there, I think Nick's question about the danger of losing membership by engaging in the United Front, so if people want to maybe speak to that,
Yeah, my name is Steve from Seattle, and there's a lot of really good points, and I agree with what Louise said about the overall, calling something a United Front today would be a little bit presumptuous on our part, because, you know, we're a small group and so forth. However, I do think the approach of the United Front is applicable to us in certain cases today. It wouldn't be a classic United Front, but let's say we're on a college campus and the anti-abortion start coming and we want to form the United Front against them with other student groups. Mm-hmm. And what we want to do is mobilize the membership of those other student groups. And in certain cases, it might seem a little funny, but we would also be making an alliance with the local Democratic Party Club on the campus, right? Now, they're formally representatives of a bourgeois political party, et cetera, et cetera. But they have a base, to the extent that they really actually have a base on the campus of other students that we want to engage with, then we could form what we might call a United Front type of approach with them and other groups. So I think that's one place where it's relevant. And then the question about how do we stop people from being pulled away in the United Front, I think that's really, really important, and that's why Andrea was stressing the idea that you got to be independent. So it isn't, you know, you go in as, you know, members of the ISO, you're open with your politics, and you're trying to build a certain political struggle, and you put forward strategies and tactics to do that. but you're also very clear with people that ultimately you think it'll take a revolution to really bring about, I mean, we might be able to stop this particular aspect or that, or bring about a reform or something like that, but the underlying problem that we're dealing with cannot be solved under capitalism, no matter what it is, and therefore we think a revolution is necessary, and we're trying to win people over to that. So I think you're right, there can be a danger of people getting pulled away in any kind of coalition work. Socialists who are building a movement, who are building socialist organizations, can be pulled in what we call a movement destruction, and just focus on building a movement without focusing on building a revolutionary party. That's always a danger, so we have to understand the theory of the United Front, understand what we're trying to do, and try to, you know, be very clear about that. So it can happen, but if you apply it correctly, then it doesn't have to happen.
Again, if people want to raise questions that haven't been raised, or any questions about maybe some of the terms that Andrea used, or, you know, really, it's this is the time to get those out. So you wanted to come back, Louise?
Yeah, I was going to say something about why you don't, well, how you guard against the danger of losing members. Because, yeah, like, you'd never do anything if you were worried, like, any alliance with any other forces, you could potentially lose people. But it's about having a confidence that it is actually only revolutionary politics that can be a guide to actually defending the working class. And I think the historical examples are important. But the provisional government that Kerensky, right up to the end, was trying to make deals with Kornilov, had no orientation to mobilising the working class to defend his own government, was just trying to, do backroom deals. And that actually what was needed to stop Kornilov was mobilising workers, rerouting the trains, just agitating, using the actual power that the working class has, that the, Kornilov and governments depend on, actually mobilising that power to, bring him down or stop the coup. And so it's about having a confidence that we want this alliance because it's our politics, it's revolutionary ideas, it's looking to the power of the working class rather than some idiot to run things that is, is the power that can win. And so, you've got to start from the point of view of, going to this alliance to demonstrate the superiority of revolutionary politics. And, if you can't do that, well, you're wrong, aren't you? So, it's about, that it is actually only the working class that has the power to defend the interests of the working class.
Do you want to come back at all and answer those questions? I could. If people are... Yeah, go ahead.
What do you see as a way to build a united front nationally against the war in Afghanistan? I mean, it seems like the major groups that have been leading the demonstrations nationally, lead into Democratic Party politics, and speaking of UFPJ,
for
Peace and Justice, and then the answer is run in a way that is really not very democratic, and I think that's a major part of the United Front. So what do you see as a way to make a real United Front against imperialist wars?
That's a great question. So I'm gonna give it back to Andrew to answer some of those, but please, if you have any questions or comments, raise your hand and we'll come back for discussion.
Just for clarity, so, like, I'm confused in the sense that, like, the classic United Front socialist supposes a mass organization, or, like, a big enough organization that we can actually buy and in practice challenge reformist leaders and do that. So to say that, like, calling something United Front today is presumptuous, but then on the other hand, it's like, what's a United Front tactic for the anti-war movement? And so is it presumptuous, not presumptuous? I'm kind of confused.
Okay. So I'm going to leave yours to the floor for a little bit longer, but I'll come back on two things. I'm going to read from Duncan Hallis, who's the commenter, and this is a good reading if you want both information about the Third International, but it also gets into a lot of United Front kind of strategy and tactics. And just on the question of the Popular Front versus the United Front, so Hallis is speaking about the French Communist Party, the PCF, in the 30s. It's worth stressing the difference between the policies adopted by the PCF in its Popular Front period and the tactics of the United Front as it had been understood in the early years of the Comintern. Whereas the Second Congress had spelled out the importance of communists maintaining their political independence, the PCF suspended all criticisms of its socialist allies. The PCF suspended all criticisms of its socialist allies, whereas unity had been understood as practical agreement for particular action designed to test the reformist leaders in the eyes of their supporters. It now came to mean an electoral bloc that tested no one. And whereas cooperation between revolutionaries and others had once centered around workers and their organizations on the basis that revolutionaries had to achieve a majority in the working class, the PCF now extended its passive, uncritical unity to the organizations of the bourgeoisie. In the name of anti-fascism, the interests of workers were subordinated to those of the French ruling class. So it's questioned, you know, there's a number of things in there that I think a couple of folks have addressed, you know, but talking about whether we're allying with the working class or the ruling class, whether or not we're open socialists or otherwise, and the popular front line, which I completely agree with Roger, is completely different from a united front. That little passage kind of exemplifies all of them. And I'm glad that the question of kind of the traditional definition of a united front or united front tactics versus what we're doing today came up, because I think it's an important distinction to make and one that's often gets lost in united front activity. I think you know, when Trotsky and when the ideas of the united front were first formulated, you were talking about organizations that had large, you know, not the majority of the working class, but like large people, large amounts of members or large groups of people that they could mobilize kind of behind their banner to add to, you know, if you're appealing to another organization and you're a revolutionary organization appealing to some other organization that you want to work with in, you know, on a specific issue, you were actually talking about like, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people that you could actually mobilize to come out and fight, you know, so you're making an appeal on a very large basis today. I don't think we're anywhere close. I don't think there's any left group that's close to having that type of a membership base that it could mobilize. So that's why there's as I think Steve put it, like we can, it's the general tactics and the ideas of the theory still apply, but in terms of a traditional definition or what a united front kind of traditionally looked like, I don't think we're quite there, because it's not like, you know, we as the ISO could go up to, you know, UFPJ and the anti-war movement if they were actually well, there's issues with UFPJ and say, okay, let's call out, you know, between your organization and our organization, we could get call out, you know, like 3 million people to fight against the war. We're nowhere close to that. So I think that the general, you know, the strategy and tactics, especially, you know, about being clear about your politics and not becoming like absorbed in more liberal or reformist politics, you know, that most definitely still applies. The fact that we even need to unite with other people in order to struggle forwards and to win, you know, people that are radicalizing to revolutionary conclusions, that's definitely, you know, still an applicable point. And there are organizations or there are kind of leftists or revolution or so-called revolutionaries out there that actually don't see that as like a necessary part of our project of rebuilding a revolutionary left that we need to be allying with, you know, other workers and engaging people and winning them farther left. So, you know, generally the tactics still apply, but the actual traditional definition is a little bit different because we're not at the point of mobilizing millions of people yet.
Roger?
Oh, yeah, me? Okay. Oh, I'm on. Yeah, I mean, I just want to echo what Andrea said. I mean, that to me, I think we just have to, it's like whether to call it United Front or not. I mean, I think that is the model that we're using. I mean, those tactics were developed, and it's and okay. I mean, to start with, United Front, right, is a term that Marxist, particularly Trotskyist, used in the first place. You know, I mean, we're going to work with people in movements who don't know, who've never used the term, or maybe never even heard the term United Front. But it's like, why can't we work together on this if we agree on this particular thing? And that's kind of what we're starting from. It's not, we don't want to go into the movement being the one who are like the splitters. Well, this would have worked had the socialists not stood in the corner and said, you know, we're not going to participate with you because you don't agree with us on everything. That's not how we approach stuff, because, I mean, that's just not how people's ideas develop. If we're going to approach the anti-war movement and say, we're willing to work with anyone who fully agrees that we need a workers' revolution, then we're going to actually be working with a pretty small group of people right now. You know what I mean? Like, but I mean, we start with the idea that ideas can change in the course of struggle. I mean, it's worth pointing out the free speech movement in Berkeley in 64. I mean, like, that was a united front method and tactic that were used there. People who were organizing in the free speech movement on campus there Not was it just socialists and other radicals. It included not just campus Democrats. It included campus Republicans who actually said, this is bullshit that the administration is going to tell us at the Institute of Higher Learning that we don't have the right to do some political activity on campus. Now, how far does the socialist agreement with college Republicans, anyone who's worked at college or worked with, dealt with college Republicans, like, it's like, there's not a lot to agree.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I don't see such an alignment happening at the given moment. But the fact that, you know, like, on those grounds, yeah. Like, you know what, if you're going to say, you know, we can work together on this. Right. Well, damn sure going to say when you stand up and say something else, like, you know, free speech, say, you know, college Republicans, also applies to groups that you don't think actually should have free speech. You know what I mean? Like, say, blacks. Or whatever, you know what I have? You know what I mean? Like, so, I mean, being able to, that's that right to criticize that we don't give up. I mean, the slogan of the United Front is march separately, but strike together, right? Maintain your political independence, but combine the strength against a common enemy or for a common project at a given moment. So I think whether or not to call it United Front or not, I think we do understand that there's, you know, the theory developed in a different moment, but that is still the model that guides us, even if it looks different on the ground at even time when we're talking about a different level of class struggle and a different level of organizational size and strength.
All right, I have Steve.
Yeah, a couple things. The thing on the NPA, I think it's a really important issue. It's something that we're going to have to really get into a lot more. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it really applies at all to the United Front or the Popular Front. Because what it is is an attempt to organize a particular type of revolutionary party or left political party. So it's not a Popular Front have different political forces within it. It was like a classical Popular Front was like in Spain or France, where there's a coalition government and the Communist Party was involved in it, and the bourgeois parties were involved in it, and so forth. They were still separate parties, but they had a common political program. Whereas the NPA is just one, you know, basically one political party. But the problem with the Popular Front, one problem with the Popular Front is that the revolutionaries within it had to take responsibility for what that government did. So the Communist Party was part of the Popular Front. And then when the French government, of which it was part, started cracking down on strikes and telling workers to go back to work and so forth, it was like the Communist Party had to defend that, right? Because they were part of the government. Mm-hmm. And that was that. Mm-hmm. So what you're basically doing is selling out to politics. Mm-hmm. You're giving your politics up to other political forces when you're involved in the Popular Front, as opposed to the United Front. And I just want to give one example. You know, Andrew talked about some examples in Germany. One other example was in the fall of 1923. There was a revolutionary situation in Germany. The workers were getting more and more radical. There was massive inflation. All sorts of things were happening. And in the judgment of many people, including Trotsky and other people, the German situation was coming right to the head of a revolution. The German party had been burned by ultra-left activity that it had engaged in before, so it was skittish and afraid to carry that forward. So what they did was they formed the United at that point when it was a revolutionary situation. Mm-hmm. They formed the United Front with the Social Democrats, and they went to them and they said, "We want to have a revolution, but we want it to be launched by the government of Saxony, which was dominated by the Social Democratic Party, and we are willing to launch the call for the revolution as soon as you guys agree to it." So they're going to the reformists and saying, when you become revolutionaries, we're ready to launch the revolution. And, of course, reformists are not revolutionaries, and therefore they didn't want to do it. And so they, at the last minute, they pulled back and said, no, we're not going to do it. The Communist Party said, well, there goes our United Front. Well, forget it. I guess we can't do it.
Yeah.
So the idea that the United Front is a defensive tactic and not an offensive tactic, I think, is really, really important.
There's still a question that by this person right there about kind of what are the potentials for applying United Front tactics or strategy to ending wars like the war in Afghanistan. So that's still something that people can feel free to speak to or also bring up other questions.
I'm curious about what people here think about countries in Latin America like Brazil and Venezuela that have had to make a lot of compromises because of capital flight. We talk about the 20s and the 30s and times when clubs were the biggest risk for people, but now it seems like that's a very big issue.
So we have about 10 more minutes of discussion, so sort of the last minute to get those questions in, or, you know, attempt to answer some of the questions that have been put out.
Raise your hand or you get called on.
I'm going to start randomly picking people.
So I'm not gonna get really into the question about today rebuilding an anti-war movement and United Front activity, because I think there's kind of a larger there's the discussion about like the anti-war movement and the forces on the ground that's really kind of specific to that movement, and the anti-war movement I feel is in a rather unfortunate place right now, and that it doesn't really. It's not very strong. It doesn't really exist. You've got these national organizations. UFPJ is kind of tacking all over the place with what they're doing, whether they're, you know, an anti-war organization or a larger organization. ANSWER. I'm not even quite sure what they're up to these days, because the anti-war movement generally is just kind of been in decline for a little while. You know, it would be amazing if we could rebuild. You know, if we could go to any of these organizations and actually make a call for a united front. I don't think we're in that place, and I don't think even when those organizations were functioning that would have been something that necessarily would have helped the anti-war movement. And I think part of it, it would have been, we worked with those organizations and we worked with people in those organizations, but I think that actually, if anything, that particular situation with do we go to UFPJ or do we go to ANSWER and form a united front against the war goes back to kind of this question of, you know, the traditional definition of a united front. Like, there simply aren't even the forces on the ground, like the ISO or other organizations, to be saying, like, let's form with you, UFPJ, to form a united front against the war. Like, we're not even in that situation. We're in the situation of, okay, we can work with you guys on kind of a, you know, with your local organizations to move forward. So I see that's why this question of a traditional united front versus the situation we're in today is kind of an important one, because I don't really see on any of the issues that are kind of at hand, you know, be it the, you know, the gay marriage movement, single payer healthcare, any of these things, there aren't really like large organizations that we would be going to and saying, okay, let's block together to fight for this particular thing. Like, we work with organizations and within coalitions, you know, with the ideas and kind of the strategy of the tactic of the United Front in our minds as what's guiding us in that work. But it's not kind of this official, you know, here's our organization coming to your organization, let's work together on this specific thing. We're not kind of in that place. I'm just going to agree with what Roger said about the NPA and what's going on with the French Capitalist Party, and I'm not really up enough on what's happening with that to entirely make much of a comment, so I would just defer that to folks that have a little bit more information. I wasn't sure Capital Flight in Latin America, I wasn't quite sure what the question was, so we could maybe talk about it afterwards informally, but I think generally, you know, the United Front is really crucial both historically to understand where it comes from, and there's kind of a lot, you know, there's a number of examples, and there's kind of a whole lot of history regarding where the theory of the United Front, you know, stemmed from as it relates to Stalinist lines with a popular front later in history, the German Revolution, and events in Germany after the German Revolution, I think are really crucial for a better understanding of that entire trajectory, both of the United Front, of the Popular Front, you know, the alliance or the false alliance that I spoke of, you know, with the Nazis, where you have the German Social Democratic Party or the German Communist Party, effectively, you know, this line of social fascism, and saying we can't even ally with the liberal, you know, the liberals are just as bad as the actual fascists. Like, that was a really, really tragic mistake that came out of, you know, a whole host of historical events. But I think that we can also look to the mistakes that were made earlier regarding the United Front and miscellaneous lines that were put forward from the Comintern, the Third International, that really points to the fact that the United Front and an understanding of it and the reasons why we engage in United Front work and why we don't, and when we engage in United Front work and when we don't, is really crucial. Because I for one, I'm hoping that I will never be out on the street with a fascist hand in hand, you know, in support of a strike. Like, that's absolutely ridiculous. So understanding this history and theory is really crucial. I brought up the Comintern as a good reading. I would also just really suggest, do folks know about the Marxist Internet Archive? I know that I've heard that term's term's been thrown around by people at talks. You know, people are like, oh, the MIA, go there. It's the Marxist Internet Archive, Marxist.org. Has like everything you could ever want to read on by leftists on it for free, and I would highly suggest folks go and actually read Trotsky's pamphlet on the United Front. It's actually really easy to read, especially the first part where he's kind of talking more about the United Front, and then he gets into some stuff that's specific to what was happening in France at the time. But he lays out really clearly the ideas of a United Front, why we engage in a United Front, how we engage in a United Front, and it's, you know, it's super accessible for folks that are kind of scared to read Trotsky. Don't be. He's an amazing writer. Because this history is really important, and it does apply, you know, even though we're not officially, you know, engaging in the traditional definition of a united front, the tactics are still incredibly relevant to the work we're doing today. And I think as we continue to see upticks in struggle, as we continue to see people radicalizing, they're going to become even more and more relevant. You know, there's a lot more things that we're out there on the ground involved and engaged with now, because there's a lot more going on than there was 4 or 5 years ago. 4 or 5 years ago, it was only the anti-war movement, as sad as it was at the time. Now, there's a whole host of other things that are very exciting. I mean, there's a lot of people that we can be involved and engaged with the ultimate task of winning them, I think, closer to our side of revolutionary activity. You know, not just the fight for reforms, but a fight for socialism also, so that we don't have to be fighting for reforms, you know, unceasingly and forever. And understanding the United Front work, I think, will help us to do that. So, you know, next time when I have a Sunday morning talk, I've given talks at the Sunday time slot in the past, and I know that I need to bring, like, donuts and coffee or something to get people going. Like, so, next time, if I have the Sunday morning time slot, you know, I'll have donuts and coffee.
All right. Well, thanks, Andrew. That was great.